do. And all the arguments today will pivot on the allegation that the BMW in question had a defective restraint system, a defective seatbelt itself, which caused the plaintiff to be ejected from the vehicle. Plaintiff made a motion in limine before trial to exclude that, saying that NRS 484-641 precluded any seatbelt evidence. And Judge Gonzalez disagreed. Now, we've had a lot of debate over what that seatbelt statute means. And last time I argued the seatbelt statute, Justice Gibbons pointed out that I have historically argued that it doesn't preclude seatbelt evidence. But now we are going to talk about a very narrow application. We don't have to. I've tried several times to get this court to agree with me on what the seatbelt statute means, and it hasn't. So we're going to limit it to the application that we're talking about where there is a seatbelt defect. Clearly, whether the seatbelt is being worn has to come in a seatbelt defect case. I also think, and the great weight of authority is on my side, that whether seatbelt's being worn has to come in a crashworthiness case. But I'm not sure you have to go that far in this case. Motion in limine precludes seatbelts. Judge Gonzalez denies the motion in limine, and in an order in the record at page 223 says, as plaintiff raises a claim of defect relating to the seatbelts in the subject vehicle, in order for plaintiff to demonstrate the seatbelt was defective, plaintiff must show that the seatbelt was being used at the time of the accident. That's the motion in limine. That's the ruling on the first day of trial, dated November 20th, 2006. And what Judge Gonzalez is saying is that plaintiff, as part of the prima facie case, has to prove she was wearing the seatbelt. And that makes absolute sense, because in a product liability case, you have to show defect and causation and damages. And if the seatbelt wasn't being worn, even if it was defective, it couldn't have caused the damages. Well, that was the beginning of the rulings, and then the line becomes pretty fuzzy. And I don't think anybody has quite a grasp on what the line becomes after that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. What is the line on the defense as far as seatbelt evidence?
What is it that Judge Gonzalez said we could argue? Well, first, she's saying that they have to prove she was wearing it. The night before.
I understand that, but what can the defense do as far as seatbelt evidence, period?
I think what Judge Gonzalez was saying were two things. One, she was saying and repeatedly said throughout the trial, although there were consistent statements, that we can say if the seatbelt was defective, it doesn't matter because she wasn't wearing it. Sometimes Judge Gonzalez said we could say that. Sometimes she said, no, what we had to say was if she wasn't wearing, plaintiff wasn't wearing the seatbelt, then it couldn't have been defective. Well, you know, logically, that doesn't make any sense. It could be defective. And BMW repeatedly said to the judge, well, we need to argue, just like you said in your motion in limine order, we need to be able to argue that it doesn't matter whether it was defective because a defect couldn't have caused it.
She put in the hand annotation on that order at the time she entered it, correct?
Thank you. Yes. A limiting instruction will be given at the time the evidence of seatbelt use or non-use is mentioned.
And then instruction, what became instruction 13 in the final instructions, that is the instruction she used throughout the trial, correct?
Mostly throughout the trial, not during voir dire. The instruction was not concocted until right before opening dates.
Okay, thank you.
But yes, it was. And that was, but she also gave, remember, that's just a limiting instruction. That's telling the jury how to use that. And notice there, the limiting instruction was saying it goes to whether the subject vehicle was defective or unreasonably dangerous. It's even broader. So it seems to indicate that we can argue the entire crash worthiness issue. But there are a lot of exchanges between counsel and the district court. The night before openings, now Stapleton cites this in her brief where the judge is saying, I take exception, BMW, to the portions of our draft limiting instruction that talk about causation. But she didn't. What she What she wasn't doing, she was taking causation out of the limiting instruction, but she did say we could argue it. On the very same page, 184 of the record, going on to 185, defense counsel says, now the seatbelt isn't being worn. Whether it's defective or not, they can't make out a claim. And the court says on page 185, and I think that the instruction does not need to say, and the cause of Ms. Roth's injury, because the causation is covered in numerous other instructions. It says the defect has to cause the injury. Mr. Sereghini, defense counsel, says, okay. The court says, okay. So the night before openings, the judge is saying to us that we can challenge causation as an element of their case in chief. So the next day we go in, first there's voir dire, which takes place before this. First there's voir dire. And during voir dire, we say, the judge says, would you like to make a mini opening statement? And we get up and we say, one of the issues in this case is whether the plaintiff is wearing the seatbelt. Now, plaintiff starts to object, but doesn't state a grounds. And the court says to us, BMW, that's inappropriate. This is supposed to be factually based. Well, there is nothing inappropriate with saying to the jury, there is an issue in this case whether plaintiff is wearing the seatbelt. There is a huge issue in this case. And we've cited in our opening brief the parts of the Jury Improvement Commission where it says you should be doing this. You should be talking about what the issues are in the case. So the objection isn't made. The judge tells us only to be factual. There's nothing in that altercation that has anything to do with causation. We then go to after the exchange where the judge says, I don't need to put causation in the limiting instruction. It's covered with other instructions. We say we should be able to argue it. She says, yes, you can. We do opening statements. Plaintiff repeatedly says, the defect in the seatbelt caused Ms. Roth to be ejected, and the ejection caused her injuries. We rebut those allegations by saying it isn't the defect in the seatbelt that caused her to be ejected. It's the fact that she wasn't wearing it. Now I've heard a lot from them saying that we argued sole cause, and that and Stapleton goes so far as to say we argued contribution. We are not arguing that plaintiff contributed to her injuries. What we are arguing is that the real cause, the fact, the truth is not a defect in the seatbelt that caused her to be ejected, it's that she wasn't wearing it. And we are allowed to come in and show, I think Judge Gonzalez had her thumb on what the difference is under the seatbelt statute. You can't bring in either seatbelt use or violation of the seatbelt statute as an affirmative defense. You can't bring it in to show comparative negligence or misuse of a product or superseding intervening causation or mitigation. But that's what the statute means when it says causation. We cannot say, yes, the vehicle was defective, but it doesn't matter because she could have prevented her injury with some other defect. Let's say there's a problem with the steering wheel, and it's defective and it causes the accident. We can't come in then and say superseding intervening cause, well, sure, our vehicle caused the accident, but she could have prevented her injuries if she'd worn her seatbelt. That's different from saying it wasn't an alternate cause, real cause, the truth. The sole proximate cause is that she wasn't wearing her seatbelt.
Mr. Posenberg, we go from that mini opening as you talked about, then we come all the way to the close.
Yes.
Under Leoce.
Yes, let's do that.
And then the question is, did that motion in limine preserve their ability to object to what they're objecting to in the close?
No. Justice Hardesty in Leoce talked about timely objections, talked about the use of objections. The real purpose that objections have is to educate you make an objection during trial. And at the beginning of the Leoce opinion, it actually says objections at trial. You make an objection to misconduct at trial. It educates the party. It gives the chance for the judge to remedy the situation with curative instructions. A motion in limine before trial only works for the evidentiary issue. The evidentiary issue is, does seatbelt evidence come in? Now, if Judge Gonzalez had ruled seatbelt evidence doesn't come in at all, and we had blurted out, oh, she wasn't wearing her seatbelts, that is a different form of misconduct, and it is bringing in evidence that has been prohibited. That would be perhaps preserved. But what, because it just goes to the issue of, I really think the motion in limine issue is, if you make a motion in limine and the judge says you can't bring something into evidence, you don't have to keep raising it during trial. The evidentiary issue is preserved. The misconduct issue isn't preserved because you have to object during trial so the judge has the chance. As Justice Hardesty said in Leoce, as Justice Maupin said in concurring in Cantorino, there's not much you can't fix with a curative instruction. So that it would have to be objected to at the time. And the only objections and the only basis that had to do with seatbelts during the motion for new trial were those two comments in closing argument. So we're really only looking at those two comments.
As that motion for new trial, was there a joinder motion by the co-defendant,
no.
If you recall? Not even a stand-up, me too?
No. No. But Luke, Your Honor, if I may, I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Okay, and I understand you're going to be splitting your time. Mr. Cottle, you're going to take the 10 minutes?
Yes.
All right.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. this Roth case has been with me from the inception. I filed a complaint. Ironic fate, coincidence, it was 10 years ago this month that she was rendered paraplegic. We started this case not a seatbelt case. That's why I'm humored during the arguments, during the briefs. This case is about a defect that allowed this young lady to be ejected. Defects, and there are four of them, four defects that contributed to the ability for her to be ejected, and as the treating surgeon said, could only have occurred through the rear door because of the nature of the injury. First defect was the B pillar separated. There's no dispute the B pillar separated, and that's the pillar between the front and the back door on her side of the car that keeps the doors attached to the car frame. It's separated.
At what point did it separate? It rolled several times, and it seems like there was a controversy as to whether it separated on the first roll or the second or third roll.
Factual dispute. The evidence from the plaintiffs, which, and I'll lay it out clearly, is that the B-pillar separated between 1.5 and 2 rolls, which allowed, once the B-pillar separates, that whole door mechanism moves open. And that, when the seat back then collapsed rearward for this plaintiff, she was ejected out the back 20 to 25 feet where she landed, kind of being dropped on her bottom and fractured her lumbar vertebra, which the spine surgeon said was the only injury, by the way, that she had. She didn't have any scrapes from going through the window. She didn't have any other evidence that was consistent with being stuffed through the right front window, which was the defendant's position. The defendant offered the position that the vehicle B-pillar separated after the vehicle came to rest and collapsed under its own weight. And the rear door came open because as this BMW was going in this circular motion, the latch was opened up, but it's inconsistent because the vehicle would be sitting on the door, so it couldn't open. So the weight of the evidence was the B-pillar broke open. At 1.5 to 2 rolls allowed the rear door to open, and she went out. That's why the seatbelt is such a red herring. Yes, it's an issue because once she laid the seat back rearward, the seatbelt was not and could not retain her in the vehicle. And she didn't know that because once she goes back, and the seat's designed to recline. All the evidence from the company representatives, the seats are designed to recline while the vehicle's in motion. There's no issue with that.
This red herring you're talking about, though, didn't you allege defective design as to the seat belt apparatus?
No, we didn't have Your Honors, we never alleged that the seatbelt itself failed to grab or detach or the belt broke. The allegation from John Stilson, and he's quoted in here, is that this, when the seat back was reclined in the position she was in, the safety harness did not have the ability to hold her in place because she was ejected rearward out the back.
Whether you call it safety harness or seat belt, one and the same.
Is it one and the same?
Was that alleged as one of the defects?
It was alleged that it did not restrain her when the seat back was reclined. It was also alleged that
That red herring that you're talking about was put in play by the plaintiffs.
Correct. It was. When we went to this case, I brought the motion in limine with Judge Gonzalez under Jeep v. Murray and said there never should be any evidence of a seatbelt because it's not a sole defect case. It's a constellation of defects. The jury will get lost in the seatbelt because the industry, after the government's mandate of seatbelts in 74, went about telling everybody that seatbelts save lives. So Mr. Saragini, who's notorious in this western United States for winning seatbelt cases, like he tried to do in the Sarah Davis case, and we know what happened there, had a plan to win this case by three things. One, people are ejected when they don't wear their seatbelts. Ms. Roth was ejected, therefore she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. That was his plan at this trial, and he executed it perfectly, violating the court's orders, violating NRS 484.416.4c, because prior to trial, we dropped all the negligence claims against BMW. It was simply strict product liability, which meant her conduct was not to be considered. The only issue before the jury should have been whether that product was more dangerous than she would expect when being used in a foreseeable manner.
But the jury found no defect.
The jury had
so
no choice.
So why should we second-guess the jury in this appeal?
Well, the reason is because Judge Gonzalez found that the misconduct in violating that order on the seatbelt and several other orders I cite in here, several other discovery abuses, permeated the entire trial. Now, the problem is...
Well, be specific on that. How did it permeate the entire trial?
Because I had to stand up and sit down like a jumping bean. I spent almost more time adjacent to the jury box objecting, and I heard the jury's groans when I would object. I am the classic example of what this court talks about in Leocey of over-objecting to the disdain of the jury. And most of them were sustained, but a bunch of them later in the trial, you can see the transcript is clear. Later in the trial with Witness Banks and Eddie Cooper, the judge got tired of sustaining them and overruled my objections.
But with respect to the seatbelt evidence, the objections you made are the two that are in closing argument and the one that comes out in the mini-statement during voir dire, correct?
There were more than that, Your Honor. Those are just the highlights that were brought into this record. As Stapleton points out in her brief, the seatbelt was always, and see, this is where the Saragini loses on all fours. He's such a smart lawyer. He knows that he can't talk about non-use and causation. That's prohibited by statute. And our case law and Your Honor's opinions on these issues prohibit him. So what he does is he actually does that. If you see the citations by Stapleton in their brief.
Wait, you said it's non-use is prohibited. If the issue is one of a defective seatbelt, you're telling me they can't say that she wasn't wearing it?
No, I think that there isn't a fine line here.
Well, be clear on this, because this is an important situation with me as far as this case is concerned.
The only defense in Nevada to a product defect claim is you're not using it. You're not using it in a foreseeable manner.
But if she wasn't wearing a seatbelt, it doesn't matter whether it was defective or not. It's not even an issue.
Right. But the other defects got lost in the process. The B pillar, the side door, the seat bag that broke down. And
the first interrogatory says no defect. So that not only knocked out the seatbelts, it knocked out the other three defects.
Right. They weren't allowed to consider that. That's why going into this case, I asked Judge Gonzalez to exclude all evidence of seatbelt because it was a nominal factor. Occupant restraint.
But you didn't offer to take your seatbelt affirmative claims out of the case. And all the way through the opening statement, you were arguing this is the $64,000 question. When you wear your seatbelt, should you remain in a car in a crash? That was your affirmative position in this case. And then you go to argue how the seatbelt geometry shifted when the B pillar was deformed.
Correct.
And that makes sense. I understand your point there. But the seatbelt was part and parcel of the crashworthiness claim that you yourself asserted for this woman, so it was in play. It isn't a Jeep versus Murray where they kept the entire issue of seatbelts out of the case, is it?
It is, in the sense that whether she was wearing her seatbelt or not did not dictate her whether she was injured. She was injured because the back door came open. We were not allowed to pursue that effectively in the jury's minds because the jury has been programmed, wear your seatbelt, don't get ejected. So once there was evidence, and we presented evidence of her ejection, we presented evidence of her damages, the jury automatically took Mr. Saraghini's constant violation of the court's orders, and we know it's a violation because Judge Gonzalez told us it was intentional, him violating her order on the seatbelt.
Now, Mr. Cottle, on your motion in limine on the seatbelts, did that include the harness part of the seatbelt, or no discussion of that, or was it just the belt part of the seatbelt?
It was the entire webbing part. We didn't separate it from shoulder to lap. Okay. Because once
so you're saying you asked to exclude all the seatbelt evidence, the judge denied it, and then you had to tailor your arguments accordingly because that motion in limine was denied.
Correct, okay. Because evidence of seatbelt non-use by Mr. Because I did all the underlying discovery. I knew they would bring Eddie Cooper, who's an expert in telling people seatbelts aren't being worn for a lot of reasons, and Dr. Banks, who was going to tell him she went through the front window. So the seatbelt did not get the treatment it deserved under NRS 484.416.4C because, as the court found in Jeep Murray, the existence of seatbelts can create collateral mini-trials, which in effect would have been necessary in this case. Judge Gonzalez thought she was limiting the use of the seatbelt evidence by BMW by saying only onto defects. And again, I objected to her instruction because it was broad defects. It wasn't seatbelt.
Go ahead and finish your statement.
So we were deprived of a fair and just trial because this attorney continued to violate the judge's orders, and she found that, and the discretion should be given to her finding because she was in the driver's seat through the entire trial.
Do you agree that if this case, if the new trial were upheld, that Judge Gonzalez's order was correct?
On the seatbelt? I believe not entirely, Your Honor. Would you like me to explain?
Yes.
I believe that the seatbelt evidence should be excluded entirely because it was a nominal part of the crashworthiness, and the only way to get a fair trial is to exclude the seatbelt evidence, or to her limiting instruction should be limited to seatbelt, not seatbelt car defect.
And what about your affirmative claim that the consumer expectation was that if you're wearing a belt, you should survive a rollover without serious injury? Would that order in limine apply to you as well and require you to retailor your...
I think it would. I think she has the obligation and the discretion under Jeep to exclude my evidence as well as defense evidence to get a consistent trial that is applicable to the facts and the law in the case.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And since we were asking questions, I'm going to give you your full 5 minutes as well.
Thank you. May it please the court, Gina Winspear on behalf of respondent Jennifer Stapleton. Today I hope to address, first, that BMW's counsel's misconduct in this trial deprived Stapleton of a fair trial.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure.
You didn't join in the motions.
I did not join in the motion for a new trial. However, we filed a notice of appeal on that issue and additional issues that we felt raised appellate issues. If you recall, the motion for new trial was filed about contemporaneously with the original appeal filed by my client, but went on for several months in terms of waiting for the order for a new trial while our appeal was pending. And then once that order was issued, our appeal was dismissed in lieu of this current appeal.
Okay, but I guess it's just curious to me how Judge Gonzalez brought you into this fold
without
asking for any relief.
And, Your Honor, I don't have the record in front of me, but Mr. Poulsenberg, I think, was not entirely correct. We attended the hearing on it and orally joined in the motion at the time of the hearing. And, in fact, Judge Gonzalez permitted statement and argument from us at the time of the hearing on the motion for new trial. So we were absolutely part of that, but there was not a formal joinder filed by Defendant Stapleton because the appeal that she had already filed was pending.
Okay, thank you.
We would urge that Jennifer Stapleton was not given the same opportunity at trial to present evidence that BMW was. NRS 484.641 prohibited Jennifer Stapleton from arguing contributory negligence for failure to wear a seatbelt. However, that's exactly what BMW ultimately did when they, throughout the course of this trial, raised the seatbelt issue, not simply in compliance with the order in limine. The order in limine was very easy to comply with. All BMW had to argue and to assert by way of their evidence was that the seatbelt was defective and Allison Roth was not wearing it. But they didn't stop there. Each time they raised that issue, they went on and said that there was no defect in the belt, so if she had been wearing it, she would not have been so severely injured. They went beyond the order in limine by essentially arguing contributory negligence. My client was prohibited from taking a similar tact in this trial, both by the order in limine as well as by the...
Counsel, as I asked previously, was there a contemporary objection to that?
There were objections throughout the trial to...
To that particular question, though, that line.
That line was not just once. It was multiple times throughout the trial, and it was objected to at times, and it was not objected to at times because the order in limine was standing and in place. And I would submit that Richmond versus State establishes that the order in limine should govern the course of the trial, that the parties had the right to reasonably rely on that order
in
limine.
But does it cover as to a Laoce violation?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Does it cover reference a Laoce violation, the misconduct?
Does Richmond? It does not. Richmond does not reference a Laoce violation, but Laoce did not involve a motion in limine. It involved contemporaneous comments and misconduct by counsel during closing arguments.
But in Richmond, the proponent of the evidence, the person who moved in limine lost, and that was enough to preserve their intention to introduce that evidence that the judge said would be excluded. In this case, the motion in limine was denied, except to the extent of the limiting instruction that was given. And so I think, could you comment on Mr. Poulsenberg's argument that to preserve a misconduct claim as opposed to preserve an evidentiary objection, you have to object at the time the order in limine is violated?
I would submit that the order in limine was not denied. It was essentially granted with limitations, and that the objection does not need to be contemporaneous for the very reason that set forth in Richmond, that it creates a negative pall over the course of the trial and over the course of the objecting attorney, which is exactly what happened here. Mr. Cottle, in particular, led with the objections as to the seatbelt evidence, and there was clearly a frustration on the jury's part that Judge Gonzalez, a seasoned trial attorney, seasoned trial judge, recognized, and that's why in her order in limine, or her order granting new trial, she says that BMW's misconduct affected the verdict. And that while there were objections, they were not constant. And I don't believe Richmond stands for the proposition that the objection has to be contemporaneous when it's misconduct alone. I think it can and has been applied by other courts to in limine prohibit activity and evidence being submitted that is not in compliance with the order. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Let me see if I can go through the Laoce analysis as I understand it. There are three things that the judge mentioned, which are two more than plaintiff mentioned in the motion for new trial when it comes to seatbelts. You have the mini-opening statement, and I've already discussed that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and there was nothing that went to causation there. You have the opening statements. The opening statements followed, first of all, rebutted exactly what plaintiff was saying, line for line, and also followed what the judge told us we could do the night before. Now, the night before closing arguments, in fact, Judge Gonzalez seemed to indicate that we had done nothing wrong in opening statement. Defense counsel for BMW said that I was simply going to make, this is on page 5416 of the appendix. I was simply going to make, talking about the closing arguments the next day, the same points I made in opening statement. So, the court interrupts, and I think you're going to be okay because you didn't get slayed during your opening statement, so you're unlikely to get slayed or held in contempt after closing if it stays along the same lines. Was there an objection during the Leocha analysis? Was there an objection during opening statements? No. And it seems to indicate more that there was no misconduct rather than simply that it was unobjected to misconduct under the rubric of Leoche. And even if it were a permeation just during those lines in the opening statement, you'd have to show that there was nothing else that could have caused this. In Grosjean, which I prefer to call Grosjean, the court looks again at Leoche and says, well, is there any evidence? Look at all the evidence. I have only half of the appendix with me here. We have 1,600 pages of transcript where both sides competed on this. You cannot say that those lines during opening statement so permeated this case that it was the only possible reason under plain error that BMW would have won, that the jury would have said no defect. And the night before opening or closing arguments, at page 5424, the court says, you are permitted to argue that if the seatbelt is defective and she was not wearing it, that particular defect would not be the cause. So even then, the night before closing argument, I've moved to supplement the argument with a part of the transcript that wasn't transcribed, which has the judge saying the complete opposite thing. But here you have the direction that what we were saying during closing argument was fine. And even if it wasn't fine, they objected at the time. The judge came down, she read, and it's in the transcript, she not only read the limiting instruction again, she wrote another curative instruction, told the jury to disregard that remark, they're not supposed to pay attention to it. So under Leoche, you can't say that that curative instruction wasn't enough. And the judge doesn't say that it wasn't enough. What the judge said in the order is that curative instruction during opening statement was not enough to cure anything that happened beforehand. But that's not Leoche, and that's not permeation. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
All right. Counsel, thank you for the excellent briefing in this matter. We appreciate you being here for arguments today. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 11:30.